Want to immerse yourself in sport and the stories of athletes from across the Pacific? Well, join me, Sam Wykes, alongside some of the most talented journalists and sports commentators from across the region for Fresh Off the Field. Each week, we'll also bring you interviews with Pacific athletes leaving their mark on the international stage and those aspiring to do the same. From cricket to netball, athletics to football, and everything in between. Listen to Fresh Off the Field on your favorite podcast app.
This is an ABC podcast.
Manuia le tayau, aloha kako. Hello and get that in good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia and I'm your host, Aggie Dubol. On the show today, has Vanuatu experienced its first case of an organised armed robbery? Many are still struggling to access internet in PNG and will Pacific artists be at risk of AI exploiting our Indigenous sounds? All that and more shortly. And before we begin, let me acknowledge that our show comes to you from the lands of the Boonwurrung and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. With that, I say malo apito. Thank you for tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. Firstly, rumours are swirling in Port Vila around what's believed to be Vanuatu's first case of an organised armed robbery. Now, the robbery at the international airport last week has been described as something from a movie and unlike anything the country has seen before. Police have released little information and rumours and speculation are filling the vacuum, particularly on social media. Local media has reported several suspects have been arrested, but police are yet to comment. Leah Lonbu reports.
For many in Port Vila, it still doesn't feel real. Men dressed in wide hazmat suits, armed with what happened to be guns wrapped in cloth, robbed a truck carrying foreign currency in broad daylight at Port Vila's International Airport on December 29. The men got away in a white van with what's believed to be around 600,000 Australian dollars belonging to Western Union. Winnie Marango lives near the airport, says the incident has shaken locals.
I remember we're driving back home and then I saw that on Facebook and then I thought it was usually the normal jokes that Nivens would post that and just making joke of. Because I live around, so very close to the airport, so it's already like alert me that, oh, Port Vila isn't safe anymore for us. And also we're driving to Mele that afternoon where there was a queue with the traffic and there was like a lot of police checks around town. We even got stopped. For me, it was a little bit unsafe for us, like walking around alone, but also just taking extra precautions of where you are at what time. And also like back home, we usually don't lock the door at night. But then during that 1 week, we also like checking doors and make sure that it's locked properly.
She says the robber has heightened the feeling of insecurities.
Port Vila is growing rapidly, like in terms of people are moving in and that we have expats, people migrating here, and we're not really sure what type, the type of people that are moving into our country. I guess we need to, especially in public places where we deal with money, we should have like strict securities or even at the airports, having police officers around the airport area. But then it comes back to giving awareness to our communities, ensure that young people are aware of what could be the consequences of committing such crimes as this.
Police confirmed some details in the aftermath of the robbery, but have been silent since as they search for those involved. The case has gripped the nation and so rumours and speculation on social media have filled the void. Community youth advocate Edmond Saksak says the lack of information from police is creating concern.
Vanuatu needs to grow up. This law enforcement department needs to grow up. All of our leaders need to grow up. I cannot blame anyone because I would say our government and even the law enforcement needs to be more transparent. Information need to be out there because you see now, no one knows anything. It's the media that spills out. And then they were shocked and then they come out to give out the information. Just going to say, I thank God that we have media If there's no media, we wouldn't know any of these things.
Mr. Saksak says there's been a lot of debate comparing the robbery to misuse of public funds by politicians.
I think this robbery is not only, this is not about pointing provinces or pointing a youth. This is about all of us. We must work together to stop this crime. It's better to ask them, what is the motive behind this robbery? So if we know the motive behind that, then it will cover the, just pushed away all our reasonings of pointing fingers, you know? I don't know. It's just so sad. But I just want all the leaders just to come down and work with us. If you want this nation to change, you cannot do anything up there without us.
Local media reported yesterday that several suspects have now been arrested. Both the VPTC and the Vanuatu Daily Post also had videos of a convoy of police vehicle leaving the airport yesterday, transporting the suspected ringleader of the robbery who was arrested in Santo. The police department have confirmed to local media that a press conference will be held this afternoon.
And that's Leah Lowenbu reporting. Now, the Pacific region has some of the highest rates of violence against women in the world. And this morning, we're looking at the Republic of Marshall Islands, with 48% of women there having experienced physical violence by a partner in their lifetime. And because of this, there are concerns that many do not seek protection through the courts against their abusive partners. And why is that? Well, to help us understand this more, we're joined by editor of the Marshall Islands Journal, Giff Johnson. With that, I say yakwe. Good morning, Giff.
Good morning. Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate your time this morning. I know you've reported on this. I want to know, from the data you've seen, what does this actually really tell us about the scale of domestic violence faced by women there in the Marshall Islands?
Well, you know, I've lived here for a long time. And one of the things, when you're in the conversation locally and you're just around and talking to people, you just hear so many random comments from women about, oh, the neighbor did this to the wife. Oh, somebody down the road, this. I mean, it's just like all the time happening. And, you know, you mentioned about the high court and why aren't more women seeking help through the high court. The thing is, about 10 years ago, the high court changed its procedures to make it much easier for women to access temporary protection orders, right? Just like streamlined it, just made it easy form to come in and like kind of check mark. And so a lot of, like over time, quite a lot of women have used it. But interestingly, in the last like 4 or 5 years, the numbers have gone down fairly dramatically from 10 years ago. And I mean, there are just a lot of factors in play for, that are a reason behind that, I think.
And that's what I would like to ask next, Giff. I mean, what are some of those major factors or challenges that these women are facing when they are possibly trying to seek protection?
Well, there's a whole range of things, which include things like family members not supporting the victim and discouraging the victim from seeking help, or alternatively just blaming them, you know, like they, it was like they deserve to get beaten or whatever. I mean, that's kind of a theme here, where family members, aunties and so on, don't really get behind and help the victim in a positive way. And so there's just like, there are these family and cultural constraints, and just like generally in a small island, people have a really hard time doing something that's like, take your boyfriend or your husband to court. Like, it's a really dramatic step for people. And what we've seen is like the way the temporary protection order system works here is the judge almost always, like 99% of the time, in response to the woman, will right away issue a temporary protection order that orders the person, the guy doing it, 200 feet away, no communication, et cetera, for a month, basically 28 days. But then they come back in for another court hearing to determine if the woman wants to make it a permanent protection order or to drop it. And most of the time, a lot of the time, women drop it. So they just use the temporary protection order, I think, as kind of a wake up to their partners, like, knock it off. Like, if they're going to stay with them, like, and why do they stay with them? Well, maybe the men have jobs and the women don't. And so, you know, they're the bread earner in the family and they've got kids together. And it's, you know, there's all those complications wrapped in.
From what you're explaining, Giff, I mean, gosh, it seems like a bit of a process, right, for a woman to have to already deal with the situation itself and then have to try and seek protection. I'm wondering, though, and I'm sure probably many are asking this question, are these protection orders effective enough for women who do manage to then finally access them?
Well, they seem to be, like, they seem to work, like, generally, like, they help. I mean, in talking to people and seeing how it plays out, generally the temporary protection orders have been useful for women. And I mean, it puts the men on notice that if they violate it, well, then they've got a higher level of a problem, right? So, you know, in that way, it's been really useful. I think it's just there's like a big challenge here of for a variety of reasons, women staying with abusive partners. And some of that is wrapped into like cultural norms and what have you. And kind of an interesting sideline on this is that like a long time ago, like, you know, 50-100 years ago, the system here was that when a couple got together, whether they were officially married or not, but they were considered married, is generally the man moved in with the woman's family. I mean, that was the custom, right? And so the woman has her brothers, her sisters, her parents around, and that's a built-in level of protection. Well, that doesn't happen so much nowadays, right? Because a lot of times it's the male, so the woman moves in with the male, or they move in together separately, just in their own place. And so those layers of protection that existed in traditional society are out the window for a lot of women these days.
Wow. I'm wondering, has the Marshall Islands government sort of responded to these types of concerns, though?
So there's the National Women's Group here is very active on this. They run a safe house for women who've been abused, and they help them with getting access to the courts and whatnot. So that's been an important factor, like just to have like you've got a place you could get out of an abusive situation. And the National Women's Organization has done a lot of consciousness raising, done a lot of promotion on this, particularly like training police to understand how to respond to victims, because you got a male-dominated police force, which kind of a lot of the guys in the police force, they're not very sensitive to domestic violence, right? So that's one of the things that's been worked on a fair amount over the last few years, is try to, you know, bring in like the different players and get them to understand how to respond and what to do. So there are things going on, but yeah, it's like, it's a serious problem. There's no question about that.
Yeah, so Giff, are you saying that the call is that these women need to be coming to the High Court, trying to get those protections? Is that the call?
Yeah, well, the way it works is they go to, we have a free legal aid office, which is actually in the courthouse building, and they just go and talk to one of the attorneys. The attorney helps them fill out the form, and then the attorney files it for them, and the judge will call a hearing like the same day, like sometimes right then, or at the latest the next day. So it's a, you know, it's a process that respects the woman who's filing the complaint, right? I mean, they get treated very fairly by the court, and they, you know, that whole process is fairly simple, but it's the, you got to have the guts to walk into the lawyers, you know, the free legal aid office in the first place. And that's a big challenge for a lot of women, I think, just to, you know, say, I'm going to do this against my partner.
Are you aware, though, Giff, of any maybe like NGOs or women's groups, you know, that might be able to step in where, well, I would say the state falls short?
Well, I mean, as I say, the National Women's Group with me, like they're very active on gender-based violence. I mean, that's a big thing. And there's a lot of like donors are very supportive of programs to try to intervene on this. So there's a fair amount of funding that's been coming in to try to support groups like the National Women's Group and some of the maybe other NGOs that provide counseling services, you know, various levels of intervention. But I think, you know, an area that obviously needs more work is on the law enforcement side and like just increasing the sensitivity and understanding of police, of the first responders who, you know, like because they're mostly male, might be inclined to ignore something. And, you know, these are areas like I'm sure in most Pacific Island countries, there are challenges like that where, you know, you've got a male dominated police force and men are the ones primarily causing the domestic violence. And like the cops just aren't really prepared to intervene in the same way, say, in Australia or New Zealand, you get a 911 call and the two police are knocking on your door in 10 minutes. Like, it doesn't work like that out here.
Mm. Well, look, it's such a big conversation to continue to have, Giffen. I appreciate you reporting on this and coming on the show this morning. That's all the time we have, but we will keep in touch.
That's great. Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. That is editor of the Marshall Islands Journal, Giff Johnson. And just to know, if this conversation has brought up any concerns for yourself and you're in need of help, there is the Marshall Islands Domestic Violence Helpline. It is 625-5290. 625-5290. Also, for Fiji, it's 1560. Solomon Islands, 132. Or Vanuatu, 161.
Do you want to know how to take better care of yourself, whether it's your body or your mind? Pacific Pulse on ABC Radio Australia has the answers. Pacific Pulse brings together experts, movers and shakers, and the wise aunties and uncles from across the Pacific to break down our health challenges. From how we care for our bodies to the health impacts of culture and island living. Join host Melissa Macon for Pacific Pulse Wednesdays at 6 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
My name is Aggie Dubon, and this is Pacific Beat. We're going to be talking artificial intelligence, or better known as AI. It's continuously evolving itself within the music industry, and many welcome it. But for some artists across the Pacific, there are concerns that Indigenous sounds, cultural knowledge, without consent, could be at risk of exploitation. So to help us understand this more, we're joined on the line from Fiji, singer and legal consultant, Natalie Iraikandroka. With that, I say Yandara, Natalie, and Happy New Year.
Yamavinaka, and Happy New Year to you, Bula. Yeah.
Appreciate your time. Look, firstly, the digital era is here. It's not going away. But quickly for our listeners, could you just maybe give us a brief explanation on what artificial intelligence or AI is?
Artificial intelligence is the use of technology and information readily available on cyberspace. For the end user, so it's a use of it's a most recent technology that a lot of creators are relying on. I mean, it's been here for a while now, but it seems that its increased use in the music industry is becoming a concern.
Yeah,
for many of creators.
And as I mentioned in the intro, saying, you know, AI is evolving within the music industry. For you, though, then, Natalie, how is it starting to show up in the Pacific music industry?
Yes, we're starting to see an increase of a lot of AI-generated music, and we're starting to see the listeners tuning in more and opting to listen. Listen to more AI generated music, and it's hard. It's difficult already to try and find a space and find your audience in the music industry, and now we have to compete with AI generated music.
And that's the thing, though. How concerned are you, though, for artists, especially in the across the Pacific realm, even such as for yourself, at the risk of, you know, AI coming in and possibly copying or even maybe exploiting our Indigenous sounds?
AI, you know, technology is something that that's inevitable. Eh? We will be having more AI artists creating more music, and I think for us as creative practitioners, it should not so much pose as, you know, competition or a threat to us, but to ensure that we maintain our creative integrity as composers and musicians, and be aware as well of how to use how our works are protected, how our music and how our compositions are protected, and for AI users is to be aware of how the use of certain tools or the abuse of certain tools, you could be infringing on the rights of owners copyright and copyrighted works.
Yeah, let's get into that, because copyright protection is a big thing. So I'm wondering, how can artists protect themselves or even just know their simple rights?
Yes, copyright awareness is very much needed in the Pacific. I can say for Fiji in particular, there's a need for creators and artists to be aware of their copyright, to be aware of the moral rights that are granted within our local Copyright Act, as well as our economic rights. And the uncertainty and the doubt in this is creating a lot of complacency within the industry. I mean, just recently we've had one AI creator who is also Itaoke, living overseas, using an existing work that is already copyright protected in Fiji, and using or creating some sort of a derivative or an adaptation to that original track, and now that AI generated track has outdone the original track, and it's playing more frequently here in Fiji. So
it's
almost like a competition of, okay, you have the original artist with the original vocals and lyrics and musical composition, who has to now somewhat, you know, like outdo the AI generated version. So it's becoming a concern for me as a composer. I'm not sure whether my musical friends here in Fiji feel the same way, but it can be problematic when you're using AI and you're using any tool for that matter in a way that, unknown to you, could be actually infringing on another creator's right.
Does that take this sort of situation into a bit of a legal? Is there any legal ramifications for what that person has done?
There could be, but then again, that'll depend on, you know, how much so the original artist would want, you know, the lengths that they would go to protect their work. If the awareness, if they are confident and aware in their rights as composers, they would be a bit more forthcoming when it comes to legal ramifications. In Fiji, we do not have a lot of that. I think because of the lack of awareness, all the creators just let it slide. And it's unfortunate that I'm not one of those creators. I'm somewhat of the Karen of the Fiji music industry. I'm always, you know, trying to say, you know, this is not right, and being the advocate that we need right now. But it's unfortunate that many of our artists don't feel the same way and don't share the same sentiments, and they're okay with that.
Well, then, if we're trying to find maybe solutions around, you know, the use of AI, how can then Pacific musicians like engage with AI, let's say, on their own terms without compromising, I suppose, their culture or their identity?
Yeah, I guess that would be fine. I mean, if anything, we could use AI to better, you know, modify our creation. We're supposed to be a partner with AI, as opposed to just putting in a prompt and then letting AI do 80 to 100% of the work. So Educating our creative practitioners on how to properly use the tool and how you can use AI to somewhat better what you've already created, as opposed to having it do 100% of the thinking for you. It decreases that creative flair and that, you know, that there's a human touch to our compositions. And if we let AI do all the composing, it's not the same as when you have that creative touch to songs.
Yeah. And because you also, Natalie, work in the legal realm, what then can musicians do? Like, where can they seek help in terms of trying to protect themselves?
Right. As far as this recent incident in Fiji goes, I did mention that what the composers can do, if they have, you know, a song that is trending, that's gone viral, and it's been used, it's been modified through AI, what they can do is they can take that song and have it registered at our performing rights office. In Fiji, we have the Fiji Performing Rights Association. So they can register that song, that new song. So in the case, fortunately, that it plays on the radio waves, if it's distributed commercially here in Fiji, at least the artist can get some type of royalty from the registration of that song.
Yeah, that's some really
so
good.
So that's one of
And sorry, carry on, but that's some really good information.
Yeah, so that's for works that are already, you know, that already has copyright protection, because you can use AI to modify already an existing song, or you could use AI to create generally a new song. And I don't have any issues with that. But again, the concern is, you know, how to use AI in a way and being careful and cautious of how you use works that are already protected.
Thank you for that, Natalie. If anything, just steps moving forward, though, what should artists do right now?
I think, as I mentioned in previous interviews, AI is inevitable. It's here to stay. Technology is here to stay, and it'll only get more advanced with time. Learning the proper skills to be a now with AI, you know, to create something better. Also relying on your human creativity and not letting AI because there's a ownership issue as well when it comes to purely AI generated works. So if you're going to use AI for the composition of a new song with the lyrics and music, then you would only be able to copyright the human components of the song and not the entire song, because AI created works will not qualify under copyright protection. So I guess it's just the burden falls on the artists and the burden falls on the users of AI to be aware of, how to use it properly in a way that you're not infringing on other creators' works.
Very insightful there, Natalie. Really appreciate your time this morning.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
No worries. That is singer and legal consultant Natalie Irakandroka here on Pacific Beat. Now, the governor of Guam has condemned the US government's plan to lease more than 35 million acres of ocean floor for mining. The Bureau of Ocean Energy Management has issued a request for information, or RFI, offering mineral rights to Northern Mariana Islands to companies through lease agreements. It's a process that would allow commercial seabed mining to proceed, and a similar offer was made for leases in American Samoa last year. It all follows President Donald Trump's push to kickstart U.S. involvement in deep-sea mining that was formalized in an executive order signed in April last year. Governor Lou Leon Guerrero told Lucy Cooper she has not been included in any discussions concerning deep-sea mining with the federal government.
When I first read about it, I immediately called the governor of CNMI because, see, Guam is not mentioned in this RFI, but the waters that they're talking about connects into our Guam waters. So we have as much an interest in this situation as CNMI. So the governor and I both wrote a letter to BOEM asking for an extension of the comment period because, you see, they were already way into the comment period and none of us knew anything about it. And we didn't even have time to announce it out into the community so that people can make comments. So I actually spoke to the principal assistant deputy director of DOI, Department of Interior, of the Insular Affairs, which Guam falls under, and expressed my concern about it. And so we actually asked for 120 days, and they only gave us 30. So we are on a very aggressive campaign to educate our community. We're doing a whole conference of information, and we've brought in scientists and experts on deep sea mining to inform us and to educate us about the so far what the science evidence that they have about deep sea mining. And I'll tell you, it's not very good.
In April 2025, US President Donald Trump signed an executive order aimed at accelerating seabed mining. Do you feel like the process to engage with deep sea mining activity, particularly in your region, is happening too fast?
Yes, absolutely. Too fast. I don't know if they're just going through the ceremonial process of this because they have to. But I think they've already made up their minds.
More than 3,000 people from US territories have signed a petition opposing the proposed deep sea mining in the waters near CNMI, Guam and America Samoa. Are you aware of this petition? Do you support it?
I am aware of it. We have been in communication with Governor Apatang from CNMI and Governor Pula from American Samoa. And we, all three of us, are united in our position, and that is to pause any activities of deep sea mining till we get more science evidence and data about the consequences and the effects of deep sea mining. Both Lucy, you know, harvesting or even digging into the seabed, right? So they're trying to convince me that harvesting is not going to upset the ecosystem, our marine ecosystem. I don't buy it.
And how important is that marine ecosystem to the not only
Very
the people
important.
Of Guam, but this, also the economy?
Oh, my gosh. You know, Governor Pula is very concerned about how it's going to impact the tuna industry. That's one of their biggest stable industry for revenue and the economy in American Samoa. And we're concerned here about fishing, the fishing industry. We're concerned about how it's going to impact our fish here. You know, we have fishing industry, people that come here to fish for tuna, and that's going to impact the whole population of our marine life here. It's very dangerous, you know. It's dangerous. It's dangerous for the future of our lives here and dangerous for our current present livelihood.
The petition launch stated that the push for deep seabed mining in the waters of America Samoa and the Mariana Islands is a stark reminder of the limited power the people who live in US territories have to make decisions that directly impact lives, land, waters,
yes,
and future.
Absolutely.
Do you believe Guam has any power to prevent deep sea mining in its exclusive economic zone?
No. We do not. We do not have control of our waters. The control of our waters is from our coastal coast to 3 miles out. That's our EEZ. After that, beyond that, and up to 200 miles is federal U.S. And we are a U.S. territory. We are not a sovereign nation. So we even have no control. they can just come in and do whatever they want. So, you know, we're working with attorneys, we're working with legal people, we're working with scientists to see what kind of a fight we have legally and scientifically. You know, we can only hope through relationship and friendship and cooperation and working with the federal government for many, many, many years. They've been, you know, partners in a lot of our life here, including we are now, you know, the prime stand for defense in this part of the world, right? And so you leverage that and you work with that. But we really have no legal, you know, we do not. We're a U.S. territory. We are the property of the United States. It's not a laughing matter, but that's the severity of it. We have histories of people invading us, annihilating our people. We've had that history. Economically, we're not going to benefit from it. The big corporations that are doing the mining are going to benefit from it, but I don't know. I don't think we'll be at the table negotiating that.
How does that leave you feeling as governor of Guam?
I think it's total injustice. And you come in here, disrupt our marine life, take a profit, and don't even share with us.
And that there is Governor of Guam, Lou Leon Guerrero, speaking with Lucy Cooper.
For centuries, Pacific Islanders have been sharing stories that connect us across the region. Stories from the Pacific is a weekly program that continues that tradition, bringing you deep and personal stories from a diverse range of people. Athletes, farmers, artists, teachers, activists, entrepreneurs, all united by their Pacific heritage and incredible journeys. Join us for Stories from the Pacific, Wednesdays at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or where you get your podcasts.
Thank you for joining us here on Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Aggie DuBois. We head to Papua New Guinea now, where many are struggling to access the internet weeks after the government ordered Starlink to shut down operations in the country. In mid-December, government said the company did not have a license to operate in the country. It's been the subject of public debate. So on the line from Papua New Guinea to talk about this is East SEPIC Governor Alan Bird. That I say good morning and welcome to the show, Mr. Bird.
Good morning. My pleasure.
Yeah, appreciate your time this morning. I understand there are no official figures, right, on how many people use Starlink in PNG, but is it true the shutdown is causing distress for internet users across the country?
Oh, absolutely. Apparently, there's some 8,000 plus users who brought in their devices, I think mostly from Australia, given the very lax attitude that the PNG government and government institutions have towards entities like Starlink. So it's affecting a lot of people. In my province, I have a flying ambulance service that has been using these devices in very remote parts of the province to get communications up so that we can use it to fly, get information across so we can fly very serious people with serious medical conditions to the main hospital. So now that it's down, they're struggling. As an example of some of the adverse effects of this short-sighted decision.
That's unfortunate to hear. We look at the PNG government, though. They've said that Starlink does not have a license to operate in the country, right? But Starlink has told customers that it wants to provide internet once approvals are granted. So are you aware, Governor, about why Starlink is not getting a license to operate?
Well, it's a bit silly, really. We have the country's Ombudsman Commission, whose primary role under the Constitution is to manage corrupt and bad behavior by politicians and other leaders. Someone has secretly complained to the Ombudsman Commission, and it has taken the extraordinary step of going to court to prevent Starlink from getting a license, which is highly unusual, given that never once in our past 50-year history as a country has it been the ambit of the Ombudsman Commission to get involved in such things. which are, of course, purely commercial. And we have a state entity, which is the regulator, called NICTA. And NICTA is supposed to be the sole entity that is responsible for granting licenses for all kinds of radio transmissions in country. And somehow the Ombudsman Commission has got involved, which, as I said, is highly unusual. And I guess the government is complicit because it hasn't gone to court to challenge the standing of the Ombudsman Commission to actually be taking on this matter.
So really, are you saying that Starlink should be allowed to operate in the country?
Well, it should be assessed by the competent authority, which is NICTA, and given a license. And I understand that they have applied to NICTA, and NICTA was potentially a few weeks away from granting it a license before the Ombudsman Commission intervened. And that's why the whole country is stuck, because the matter is still in court. The courts haven't given it any priority, as far as I understand, to progress the matter. So I guess it's just waiting for a court hearing date, and it's been waiting for, I guess, over 12 months now.
Well, look, at the beginning there, we were talking about the fact that, you know, the shutdown has caused distress for internet users across the country. But, you know, as it's a challenge, I would say it's more of a challenge for those who are in rural areas, right? Like, could you tell us maybe the extent of the problem there in PNG?
Well, look, in Papua New Guinea, most things don't work. Power is intermittent, even in Port Moresby. Water supplies are limited in Port Moresby. And, you know, that's kind of like a preview of the entire country. I mean, people in villages have better access to running water than people in the towns and cities. So almost everything doesn't work here. And so internet and telephone services are no different. I'll give you an example. I have a small business in my town of Wewak, and it's a small hotel business. We currently have, I think, four or five telephone providers. Now, at my small business, which is in a town, not a city, I have paid for all of the five services that are available. I've got telecom, fiber cable. I've got telecom internet. I've got Digicel internet. I've got B-Mobile internet. I've got Vodafone internet. Now, and then I've also got a satellite link on my roof. Now, that's how most businesses operate in Papua New Guinea. You pay for all of the service providers, and most of them don't work half the time because they all depend on a government cable. And if someone in government doesn't pay the monthly license fee, well, obviously the cable is switched off, and which happens quite often, regular, in fact. So you don't have, if you're going to run a business, you need, in the modern world, you need access to fast, reliable internet. So for starters, most businesses don't have that. Even if your redundancy is an independent satellite connection, also approved by government and costs a lot of money, you don't have access, say, 50% of the time.
Yeah.
Now, go to a rural area, and of course they've got it even worse. So most of them, and these are like health service providers on remote islands or on up in the bush somewhere. Someone might be running a school, and so Starlink became the obvious solution because it's plug and play, and you can plug it into a solar panel. And so even while government, as I said, the application by Starlink was going through its assessment with the regulator, most Papua New Guineans who needed it and realized that it was going to be approved anyway, they all went out and bought it. There were some members of parliament even that went and bought these dishes for these satellite Starlink connections. and install them in remote places to provide services. So it's been a game changer for a lot of people, because obviously it's got, you know, high latency, and it's available, you know, 99% of the time. It's better than anything we've got in Papua New Guinea at the moment, given our, you know, very difficult topography and terrain. And not only that, it's cheap. I mean, it costs us 3 to 5 million kina to install a tower with telecommunications equipment for mobile phone connections, which of course you use for internet as well. Now you can solve that problem by just having a small, I think it costs less than 2,000 kina. So essentially, everyone can have access to the internet and to high-speed communications and whatnot using Starlink. Yeah, that's the possibility staring at ordinary Papua New Guineans.
Yeah, it's definitely a lot to compete with, Governor. But look, we just appreciate your time coming through and sharing, of course, you know, the issues that are happening there in PNG. We do hope something does come through in regards to Starlink.
Oh, absolutely. I hope, you know, smart heads prevail. I mean, we're thinking like a tribal entity at the moment. And obviously, it's someone's vested interest versus the interest of the public at play.
Absolutely. But again, thank you again for joining us here on Pacific Beat.
Thanks for having me.
No worries. That is East Sepik Governor Alan Bird joining me here on Pacific Beat. Time to take a look back at one of our main stories today. With the rise of artificial intelligence, generating music is a cause of concern for musicians across the Pacific. Now, Fijian singer Natalie Iraikandroka says local artists have to compete against AI.
It's almost like a competition of, okay, you have the original artist with the original musical composition who has to now outdo the AI-generated version.
Now, you can find those stories when you type Pacific Beat or Radio Australia into your search engine. Our team will be back same time tomorrow at 6 a.m. PNG time, but you can always hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Now, stay tuned, because ABC Radio Australia, though, is bringing you your news next, and coming up after that, it's Nisha Daily. So until next time, otoa o whātou. I'm Aggie Tupou, and this is Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.